hour. So I'm going to leave some things out. I'm going to try to spend some time on the important stuff. But this class is about you. I want you to forget the company you work for. I want you to forget your boss. I want you to forget your team. I don't want you to do group think. This is an individual process. Learning how to succeed is about you as an individual. It's not about anybody else. So stop thinking about other people. Stop thinking about your job. I want you for the next hour to think about yourself. Now, ask yourself a question right now. Do you know how to succeed? That's a yes, no answer in your head. Do you know how to succeed? I'm not asking you, do you think you'll be successful? Of course you think. Everybody thinks they're going to be successful. Do you know how to succeed? And if you think you do, can you turn to the person beside you and explain it to them? You can't. I can't either, because success isn't a recipe, but it is a list of ingredients. And that's what we're going to go through today. I'm going to give you the ingredients for success cake. And you're going to take those ingredients and you're going to mix them in your own way. They're going to be special ingredients. The ingredients are common, but the recipe is special. And it has to be yours. So prepare for the list of ingredients and then go home tonight and start baking your cake. So, preliminaries. Before we get started, I can't talk about success without talking about my success, and that's going to sound arrogant as hell. And I can't do anything about it, right? It's just will. But would you be happy with anything less? I read a book written by a dude called The Presentation Secrets of Steve Jobs. There's only one person that can write that book. That's Steve Jobs. I've seen the guy that wrote the book about how to present like Steve Jobs. I've seen that guy present. It wasn't anything like Steve Jobs. He was mediocre. He was a 4 on a scale of 1 to 50. If you're going to teach me how to succeed, speak like Steve Jobs, then speak like freaking Steve Jobs. I read a book called How to Give a TED Talk by a guy who's never given a TED Talk. That's stupid. I'm reading a book on leadership now by a guy who interviewed 100 leaders. But has never led anything himself. This isn't one of those courses. I'm successful. I'm sorry. Get over it. And I'm going to talk about it. And it's going to sound arrogant. I'm an American. Surely you're used to that. All right, enough of that. God, you all stop laughing. You're going to make me laugh. I'm in the top 1% of Microsoft. I was in the top 1% of Google. In fact, I was in the top 100 of Google. I know because Larry and Sergey invite the top 100 of Google every year to go off to a retreat and they talk. And I was invited to that thing 2 years in a row. And then I quit, so I'm no longer the top 100 at Google. But I hang out with a lot of successful people, and here is why they're successful. This is the first reason. Pedigree. Some of those people went to Yale, they went to Harvard, they went to Stanford. You get a computer science degree from Stanford and you're going to be successful. Period. You're going to get hired by Microsoft, you're going to get hired by Google or Facebook, and you're going to have a career, and you're going to make a ton of money, and you might even work on some interesting stuff at the same time, right? I can't teach that. I can't teach you how to get a degree from Stanford. You either get accepted to Stanford or you don't. This isn't about pedigree, because I can't teach pedigree. I can't teach prodigy either. There are some people that can mind meld with a computer. They're going to be successful. Because they're just that smart. That's not me. I guarantee that's not me. If pedigree and prodigy were ever in my family tree, they fell out and broke their freaking neck on the way down. Work ethic. I'm mildly allergic to working hard. If I can't get it done in between the hours, oh, by the way, don't tweet anything that makes me sound like a douchebag. Please, tweet anything you want, but don't make me sound like a douchebag. Microsoft reads those tweets, and you know, anyhow. So, because I'm going to say some things that make me sound like a douchebag. I work hard when I'm interested in the work, and I'm a lazy bastard when I'm not. So it wasn't work ethic that got me where I am. And it wasn't luck either. I turned down a job at Microsoft in 1989. Holy shit, what a dumbass, right? That was like a $100 million mistake. I worked at Google during the recession when their stock, the only period in which Google stock was flat. There are people that get lucky, right? Our current CEO is very good, but he was also, he got on the Azure train, right? The Azure train at Microsoft is the one you want to be on. Right? That's the one that's rocketing up. There are people at Google who happen to work on Chrome, yay. There are people at Google that happen to work on Google Plus, boo, right? Guess who was more successful? Why did they work on Chrome? Because they got lucky. Right? If you got a job at Microsoft in the early 90s, you're lucky. If you got a job at Google in the early 2000s, you're lucky. I can't teach luck either. So that's off the table. What is on the table are what I call superpowers. And there's seven of them. Seven career superpowers. They are skills. They are techniques. They are ideas that will make you successful. They will be your go-to skill. They work. I know they work because I've applied them and here I am. I ain't got any of that other stuff. All I have are the superpowers I'm going to teach you. I'm not going to get through all seven of them in an hour. It takes me exactly 4 hours to get through all seven. But I'm going to rock through four or five of them, and then I'm going to sell you a book at the end. If you notice, if it comes in my brain, it comes out my mouth. I don't know how to stop that process. Caution advice. Advice is approaching. There's a lot of career advice out there. In fact, there's a lot of career advice out there from really successful people. This is Jack Welch, CEO of General Electric, right? One of the richest men in the world. He has multiple ex-wives who could buy and sell my ass 10 times over, right? Successful, very successful guy. And so he wrote an article from LinkedIn about how to succeed. Here's his advice in a nutshell. Number one, work hard and over-deliver. Number two, impress your boss with shock and awe. Don't say shock and awe. It makes you sound like a dick. God, there's another one of those things. And make yourself valuable to your company. Now, mind you, this advice is awful. It's awful. Don't do any of this stuff. If you're doing any of this stuff now, stop it. Work hard and over-deliver. What the hell does that mean? Let me tell you this. Working hard is not a strategy for success. Working hard is table stakes. We all work hard. What are you going to do, be the hardest worker at Microsoft? I don't care how hard you work. You're not going to be the first person at the office. You're not going to be the last to leave. You are not going to be the one who's willing to give up more of your personal life and more of your time with your family and friends. Someone else is willing to give up more than you. You will never be the hardest worker. Hard work is just table stakes. We all do it. It ain't gonna get you ahead, so stop relying on it. What's the next one? Impress your boss. Okay, let's see. Let me count my bosses over the last 10 years. At Google, I was there for 3 years. One, two, three bosses. I've been at Microsoft for 6 years. One, two, three, four. Five bosses. Which one was I supposed to impress? The truth is, I've passed all of them but two up. If I was still trying to impress my original boss at Microsoft, I wouldn't be where I am today. I passed that guy up years ago. I'm way more successful than he is. Your boss has nothing to do with it. We don't work for the same company. Jack Welch worked for the same company for 40 years. He graduated in 1960 he graduated. You know what was happening in 1960? Here's what was happening in 1960. The Beatles named their band. The Dallas Cowboys were a franchise team. They're like the Manchester United of our football, right? New Zealand got its first television station in 1960. Things have changed since 1960. Jack Welch worked for GE for 40 years. None of us are going to work for the same company for 40 years. That's not how you get ahead. That's how you get your company ahead, not how you get you ahead. It's pissing me off. Oh, make yourself valuable to your company. Why? Do our companies cherish us that much? We just had a layoff of 18,000 people. Yeah, that hurts. Google, Apple, just been sued and paid a fine willingly because they have been conspiring to hold the salaries of their engineers down by not hiring each other. Just today, Disney, Sony, Pixar, and DreamWorks are all doing the same thing. Is your company on your side? This is one of those things you shouldn't tweet. Is your company on your side, or is your company on their side? Your company is doing what it takes for them to succeed, not for what you. Your boss is changing. Your company is changing. This is about you. Jack Welch's advice is bad. It's last century advice. It's how you succeed when you got companies still have pensions and you work for the same place all your life. Of course, you want to impress your boss if you're going to have that boss for 10 years, but it's not the way the world works anymore. Okay, now, about those superpowers. Our journey begins years and years ago in the fields of Kentucky, where I'm from. That is a picture of my father. He was about 10, we're not sure. In Appalachia, they don't keep really good birth records. Yeah, she had a baby, good luck feeding it. I don't know what day it is. That's the house. Yes, it's a homemade house that he grew up in. There were dirt floors, wooden walls with no insulation. Here's my pedigree. We were coal miners. We were farmers when the rains held. Coal miners when some nearby mountain required decapitation. We were soldiers when they made us be soldiers. This was my lot in life. There is a lot in life for everybody. There is a job that will come to you. Don't take it. Demand more. My brothers, my sisters, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts, all took, every single one of them, took the job that came to them. The job they got out of high school. The job they got from a friend. Oh, somebody's hiring here, somebody's hiring there. Okay, great, I have a job. That's not the way you succeed. That's the way you get paid. That's a job. That's not a career. Say no to that stuff. I want you to have a career. I don't want you to have a job. And I grew up around this stuff. I grew up around people who just were looking for the next meal. And I thought bigger. I thought, I don't like this. My mom cried weekly because there wasn't enough money to buy food. I didn't like that. It hurt. My father would come home, you know, he's 86 now. He's lived, but his hands don't work because he works so hard in the factory at Ford Motor Company. He's arthritic. He can barely stand. He got laid off 6 times. He drove a Pringles potato chip truck when he was laid off. Now I looked around and I thought, this sucks. I don't want this. I want more. You know what I want? I want to enjoy my damn work. I don't want to come home bitching about it every day. I don't want to come home and not have enough money to feed my kids. I want more out of my life. Why am I feeling this way? I need to change slides here. Yes, I'm ambitious. I got ambitious, and I succeeded. I tore myself out of that. I moved out of Kentucky. I got an education. I don't know how I paid for it. I figured it out somehow. I begged, I borrowed, I stole. I steal. I really do. That sensor in the hot tub I was talking about, I stole that. I wasn't smart enough to build it. I can tell you the story. I'm not proud of how I stole it either. I got my son involved. but I needed the damn sensor, man. I needed the damn sensor. Ambition, it sounds like a really bad word. Oh, he's ambitious. And we never say, oh, he's ambitious. We never say it like that. We say, yeah, he's ambitious. What an ambitious bastard. I was ambitious. Ambition is the root of all my success. Everybody says, oh, James is successful because he went to college. He was the only one of us that got to go to college. I didn't get to go to college. My ambition drove me toward college. My ambition made me study shit I didn't want to study because I knew I needed that piece of paper. I knew I needed to get out. Ambition is a good thing. Ambition is the root. If you're not ambitious, you won't succeed. If you're not ambitious, that means you're aiming here. And it's funny about aiming. You aim at something and you're going to get close to it. So don't aim here. Aim here. What if you only get here? Fine. It's more than here. Set your goals higher than maybe you're even comfortable with, because you're going to get close. Ambition is the first superpower. And if you ain't got it, none of the others matter. Because it was my ambition that drove me to find those other superpowers. It was my ambition that the root of all of my success. So when you think about ambition, don't think this is a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Being ambitious doesn't mean, oh, he wants wealth, he wants power. I want enough food and I want enough money that my family doesn't have to fret over it. I want to be able to go to work with a smile on my face. I want to be able to be at work and be engaged and look at the clock and say, holy shit, it's 6 p.m. already? Damn, I'm not done with this and I want to finish it. I want to go home thinking about with a sense of accomplishment. I want to wake up the next morning saying, all right, I get to do this over again. That's ambition. Is any of that bad? It's not bad. It's a good thing to be ambitious. And if you're not ambitious, then leave, because the rest of this isn't going to be good for you. You're not going to be able to use any of this. This is the one superpower that's not optional. Be ambitious. Okay, now, you all haven't left. And I'm going to tell you a story. I got fired because of a girl. If there is a more worthy cause to be fired over, I have not found it. So I was in a startup that was doing, it was a professor's startup, and we were doing software development, we were coding all this stuff, right? And we had these meetings on Saturday morning. We were all passionate about this stuff. Wow, this is awesome, right? Coding, coding, coding. We decided 7 a.m. on Saturday morning, we'd have our stand-up meeting, and we'd sit and we'd talk, and then we'd go off and we'd code for the rest of the day. And I loved it. Saturday's fine, I'll code anytime, man, I'm passionate about this stuff. And then I met a girl. And we had sleepovers. How cool is that, man? That was the best part of moving out, right? And man, if I have, I cannot describe how unenergetic this particular woman is. I mean, she took lazy to whole new heights. And on Saturday mornings, I would wake up, right? Time to go to work, right? I just kind of sneak out of bed, and she'd grab me, and she'd pull me back in, right? Laziness to her was a team sport. And then I'd sneak out, and she'd pull me back in. And then I'm realizing if I don't leave right now, I'm going to be late. There's a room full of nerds waiting for me at the university, and there's a naked girl in my bed. There's a room full of nerds. There's a girl. Guess who won? It happened the next week. And then my boss came in and said, James, you're fired. You're not showing up to the meetings. And I was like, dude, before you fire me, I want to introduce you to someone. No, you're fired. And so being fired was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because being fired means a restart, right? It means you got choices. And I thought about this. And the first thing I thought about was I was going to make her feel guilty so you know, I would win. And I said, guy, you got me fired. You know what she said to me? She said, you're welcome. What? You got me fired. And she said, I know you hated that job. What? You did. You complained about it all the time. You know, frankly, I don't think you're very good at it. Right? That guy, you're always talking about that really smart guy, how much better he is than you. And you're always complaining about that other guy who doesn't, his code is really bad. I think I did you a favor. I don't think you're cut out to be a software developer. And I thought, holy shit, she's right. I would have been in a career of software development and I would have been miserable because I'm okay at it. There are large numbers of people who are much better at coding than me. And it was that catalyst that made me think, now what do I do? And I came up with an idea. And I went back to my ex-boss and I said, I've got a proposal. I want you to hire me back as a tester. And he's like, tester? That's a downgrade, right? I won't pay you as much to be a tester. Fine, I'll take a cut in salary. But I think you need me, right? We're writing a lot of bugs. Somebody needs to test this shit. And furthermore, I think the tester should be independent so that I'm not biased by knowledge of the code. I can actually be an independent voice. That way I could sleep in on Saturday mornings. And he's like, okay, if you'll take a half salary, I'll hire you back as a software tester. And that was it. That was my success. Because I did something that all of you should do. I specialized in something. Specialization is a superpower. All of a sudden, I had an identity. I was the test guy. There's a bunch of developers and the test guy. The test guy, they called me. The test guy. Wow. I had an identity and nobody else did. I was automatically the test guy. And it did a lot for me. It allowed me to focus on something that I could actually nail. I don't mean to offend any software testers in the audience, but software testing is easier than development. I'm sorry, it is. It's easier. And I got really good at it. I buried myself in software testing, absolutely buried myself in it. I learned everything, read every paper, went through every website, started attending conferences, and I started having ideas about testing because I could nail it. It wasn't too hard. Development was too hard for me. I would have never been anything more than an average developer. And there are a lot of average developers out there. There's a lot of people to compete with. But I became an excellent tester. And there are not a lot of excellent testers out there. And to this day, I wrote 5 books on software testing. 2 of them bestsellers, 2 of them award winners. By the way, there's no overlap between those classes. I don't know why. And one that nobody noticed. And to this day, I haven't done software testing in years. And to this day, people say, who are the top of the field of software testing? In the 1990s, it was Whitaker, Kaner, Beiser. In the 2000s, it was Kaner, Whitaker, Bach. And now, it's still me. I'm in there with Bach and Bolton. I don't know how I got there. I haven't touched that discipline in over a decade. And yet, it took me to the top. I was a test guy. Wow. Specialization is a superpower because it turns out the best software tester in the world makes a hell of a lot more than every single average software developer. It is a lot more fun because I was able to step back and say, hey, I broke your shit, right? You all see Michelle's keynote yesterday, right? She's a breaker of things. I'm like, God, I love that job. And it opened doors that were closed to others. I remember one time, I'll tell that story later. Let's keep going. I don't have enough time for all these stories. Now, if you're going to specialize, don't specialize in something stupid. And this was the 1990s, and software testing was not stupid. It mattered to the world. I looked at this and said, we are writing bugs at a rate that is scary. And we're beginning to give names to our bugs. The Y2K bug. You know, the Y2K bug, that's on the 6 o'clock news. Everybody was scared of the year of 2000 because of a bug. I thought, this is anything that people are talking about on the 6 o'clock news is a good specialty, right? If you're good in that stuff, choose something that matters. In the 1990s, software testing mattered. It doesn't matter anymore, by the way. It's a really bad specialty now. The web killed it. The web killed software testing because you guys got to turn on your analytical brain and you've got to think about how the industry works. I'm going to talk about clairvoyance as a sidekick in a little bit. But software testing was really important because we were writing software and we were shipping it on media. I mean, literally, the U.S. mail was taking stacks of disks, and that's how you got software. You went to the store and you got a stack of disks. You can't have bugs in that scenario. Bugs are really important in that scenario because if there is one, we got to redo all those disks and reset. They're too hard to fix. I thought, man, if somebody solves this problem, this is going to be really important. And then the web came around, and the web allowed you to update software automatically. There were no more disks. And as soon as that came around, I realized, holy shit, software testing is over. Bugs aren't as important anymore because they can be fixed so much faster. And so you got to watch it, right? Pick something you can nail. Pick something you can be passionate about. And pick something that's important. But you got to be ready to change. And I'll talk about change in a minute. Now, software testing, it turns out it's kind of hard to be passionate about it. And I had the same opinion about it as Michelle did. I got passionate about the breaking part of it. And what I did is I started finding bugs funny. You know, I would kind of perfect my, because software developers don't want to fix bugs. So, but if I made a bug embarrassing, if I made a bug funny, right, I could, you know, I got really perfected my pitch about here's how to sell a bug to a developer. And so I started printing out bugs. And you know, like stupid error messages. One error message was an error has occurred while displaying the error has occurred that has occurred while creating an error report. Right? I printed that sucker out, put it up on my cubicle. I got T-shirts made with it. Right? It was because it's a funny bug. And all of a sudden, my cubicle wall had all these pictures of bugs on it. And people started contributing. Other developers like, oh, I found a funny bug in Photoshop. Here it is. Right? And my cubicle became the center of gravity of our team. Because of my passion about bugs and making that passion contagious. Choose something that matters. Find some aspect of it that you can be passionate about and learn that shit, man. Nail it. Be the guy. Be the girl who knows more about the subject than anybody else. But be careful. Specialties have a dark side. You can become a one-trick pony over time. And people who are still doing software testing after 30 years, I'm sorry, they were one-trick ponies. That ship has sailed. Software testing is no longer a career that matters. It's no longer a specialty that matters. I'm sorry. I love software testing. I would still enjoy it if I was doing it, but I'm too ambitious for that. I wanted more. So after the Y2K scare was over, they were still naming bugs, except they were security bugs, the love virus, right? Remember all those sorts of things that came around. So I switched my specialty to security. I decided, all right, I'm going to learn security. And in fact, I'm going to learn how to take what I did in testing and apply it to security so I can find security bugs. And that was my second specialty. That was not luck. It wasn't luck that I chose software testing in the 90s. I knew it mattered. And it wasn't luck that I chose software security in the early 2000s, because I saw it coming. Windows XP, one bug, two bugs. I was a professor at the time, me and my students started pounding Windows XP, and in an afternoon, we found about 100 bugs. And I thought, holy shit, this is a gold mine. I am going to use Windows XP to print money. And I did. That was where my relationship with Microsoft started. I got a big grant to help secure it, and Windows XP, SP2, and all the service releases, all those patches, I've got code in there. Many of those bugs were mine and my students, and we turned the testing specialty into a security specialty. So keep that parachute handy. Be ready to bail. Now, the other thing is, you got to be able to explain it and make it interesting. If you can't make your specialty interesting, it's not interesting. If you can't make it compelling to someone else, then it's not compelling. You've got to sell your specialty. I got really good at selling my specialty of software testing. I got good at explaining bugs. I got good at explaining security. I want you to have your elevator pitch ready. If somebody asks you, what do you do? And you say, you've lost them. Nobody cares. You got to be able to launch into that. You have to memorize this. You have to have an elevator pitch for you. And so here's my elevator pitch for software testing. You're familiar with software, of course, right? And it pisses you off when it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It won't print, or your document won't open. Well, when software works, when software does what it's supposed to do, that's me. And everybody was like, oh, wow. I just took credit for every piece of software that ever worked properly, And they accepted that. Oh, wow, you're the test guy. I said that to Bill Gates one time. We were at faculty summit. Everybody's shaking his hands, right? He was a man in the 1990s. Everybody's, oh, what do you do? Oh, I study virtualization. Blah, 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 blah. I shook Bill Gates' hand, looked him in the eye, and said that. And he said, that's freaking cool. And he kept my hand, and he kept shaking it. And he kept looking me in the eye, and he said, you know, we could really use a person like you. Do you have a relationship with Microsoft Research? Are we funding your lab? And he kept talking, and he kept talking. And he kept, everybody else had 10 seconds with Bill Gates. I had about a minute and a half. This conversation, this intense conversation, because I said that. Ready your elevator pitch. What is it? Can you say it? If not, you're succeeding by accident. You're not succeeding on purpose. Here was my elevator pitch for computer security. Your computer has to interact with a lot of other computers when it's doing things like banking transactions. Some of those computers are good. Some of those computers are trying to rip you off. I help your computer decide what other computers to trust and what other computers not to trust. Wow. I just took credit for every single banking transaction and online transaction that worked for those people, and I deflected blame for all the other shit that's gone wrong to somebody else. That's what I do. Can you sell yourself? Can you do it? You need to. This is what I'm doing now. This is my current pitch. I lack pedigree. I lack prodigy. I'm meagerly endowed with work ethic, and yet here I am at the top of my field, and I know how I did it. And I want to amplify the direction that this world is going. I want it to go into a better place, and the way I do that is to help other people succeed like I succeeded. That's what I do. So there's another aspect of this, too. This is what I told other people. I had a different sales pitch for myself. Because you got to keep your head in the game. You got to wake up every morning understanding, why am I doing this? What is my ultimate goal? Be ambitious. If you don't have an ultimate goal, you're not going to reach it. You're going to wander around. You're going to succeed by accident. I want you to succeed on purpose. My goal in software testing wasn't that. I knew it was a lie. That's okay. I lie and I steal. I've been known to cheat once or twice, too. I want to be someone in this industry. When people mention the top software testers, I want them to say my name. I want to be known in the industry. I want to be known in academia. Sounds ambitious, right? I don't apologize for it. That's what I wanted. And when I succeeded, when I achieved it, that was the point at which I said, okay, I did it. I'm a famous software tester. I'm the guy that wrote that book. Maybe I'm done. That was the catalyst that forced me to think about, okay, I met my goal, right? It's like Microsoft, a computer on every desk. Oh, shit, now what do we do? And you have that oh, shit moment, and that oh, shit moment's good because now you can question your specialty and maybe change to another one. In security, when I realized what I was actually trying to do, I just wanted the companies to take it seriously. I wanted Steve Ballmer and Steve Jobs and Larry Page. I wanted them to understand security. I wanted the people who could actually fix the problem, who could actually take it serious to start talking about security when they spoke publicly. And I remember the first time I heard Bill Gates stand up and say, we're forming the trustworthy computing team at Microsoft. Security is a problem that the world really needs to be concerned about, and we're taking it seriously. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm done. I can move on now. Right? I can't take full credit for this, but I helped move the industry in this direction. I got other people behind me, other powerful people in the community like Michael Howard behind me, and we did the same. Michael Howard's a Kiwi, one of the greatest security minds of all time. He's a Kiwi. And we did this. As an industry, we did this. I was done. So have that goal in mind. What are you really working for? What are you doing for you? What are you trying to do for the world? You have an elevator pitch for the world, you have an elevator pitch for yourself. And this is what I'm doing now. I want this boring shit to end. How many times have you all sat there and been bored to tears? We call this death by PowerPoint. It's not discomfort by PowerPoint. It's not mild irritation by PowerPoint. It's death. Do presentations have to be boring? Can we sit in a room like this and actually learn and enjoy ourselves at the same time? It's my fucking job. Storytelling is so important. I actually teach another class, advertisement. I teach another class called Storytelling and the Art of Stage Presence. I teach it monthly at Microsoft and occasionally on invitation outside of Microsoft. The ability to tell a story is very powerful, and too few people are good at doing it. And imagine the world. Imagine every school kid waking up and saying, God, I can't wait to get to school today. That professor, that teacher, Mrs. Mitchell, I can't wait to get in her class. I just learn, and I become excited about life. Can you imagine that world? That's what I'm doing. I don't know if I'll succeed. You need to be able to tell three stories on demand. Your role and specialty, your project and why your project matters, and you and what makes you special. Here's something you can't tweet. Please don't tweet this. When I worked for Google, I was a development director for Chrome, and I had t-shirts printed to just implant my project and why it matters in every one of my team's heads. The t-shirt read, "Saving the World from Internet Explorer." Since, and then the date that they started on the Chrome team, right? And everybody wore these. Everybody knew what the product was about. Everybody was into it. That team, I have never managed a team that wrote so much code, built so many features at such a pace in my life, because I could tell the story of my project and why it mattered, and people believed me. Storytelling is a superpower. It is an absolute superpower, and too few people can do it well. But if you can do it well, your story will inspire others, and productivity will be just crazy. And then you, and what makes you special? Why should I listen to you? Tell those three stories, and you'll be that much closer to success. Okay, on to another superpower. How do you learn? Do you have a mentor? How many people have a mentor? How many people have 8 mentors? Okay, stop having one mentor, because that's stupid. Really, if you just stop doing stupid things, you'll succeed. That's probably, we could probably just end the class now. When you specialize, it means there's a lot to learn. Who are you going to learn it from? You're going to learn it from a book. You're going to learn it from a website. You're going to learn it from a video. What are you going to learn from? Learn from people. Access to an expert is always the best way to learn. Science has proven this. Access to an expert accelerates learning. You want to go to people, and you want to go to a lot of people. One mentor can't teach you everything you need to know to succeed. One mentor can teach you what they did. They might be able to teach you about their specialty, and that's it. And that's all you should be using that mentor for. You should choose a different mentor for everything that you want to do. You should choose, you know, I had a lot of stuff to learn when I was in software testing. I had to learn about error logging. I had to learn about exception conditions. I had to learn about model-based testing. I had to learn about oracles. I had to, all this stuff needed to learn. One person didn't know all that. So I found that and one expert for each one of those things. For every task, find the expert that can teach you. Find one person who knows that stuff cold and hang out with them. It's really important. Never just one mentor. And in fact, be careful with mentors. The obvious ones aren't always the good ones. There was a professor in my graduate school who was really famous. I mean really famous. And everybody wanted to work for him. All of the graduate students all wanted to work for Jack Dungar because he was the guy reinventing networking. He had all this money from the National Science Foundation. He had this big house. Everybody wanted to go to his house and have a party. Oh, man, I got invited to Jack's party, right? And I avoided Jack because he didn't have anything I needed. I was studying software testing, and I was building these big matrices of inputs, right? Here's a bunch of inputs. If I apply this input, the software goes to this state, and that means this other input can be applied next, right? All this kind of stuff. And I had these matrices, and I kept looking at them. I kept studying, I studied matrix math, and then I found this field called Markov chains. And I thought, holy shit, if I take this matrix and I reformat it a little bit, it's a Markov chain. And it was a branch of math and stochastic processes. And so I went and found the professor who taught stochastic processes, because if you want a mentor, you have to choose, and you have to give to receive. I get so many emails. James, can I buy you lunch? I need your advice. I get lots of these emails. Lunch isn't enough to make you interesting to me. I'm sorry. I get at least 100 emails a month of, James, would you be my mentor? And my answer is always no. Don't ask to be a mentor. Slide in there carefully. I stalked this guy. I figured out when he got to the office, and he got to the office early, so I got to the office a little bit earlier. I figured out his coffee routine. I'm going to be in there when he gets coffee. I just want to say one thing clever and do one thing. Right, I took his class. I couldn't. He would teach the class. He's a boring professor, and he'd go through the class. None of that was working. And so I decided, okay, I got to get closer to this guy. He had an office, and there was a corridor that went down, and there were a bunch of graduate carrels in the corridor. And so I swapped with someone who had I had a bigger office, and I swapped with a junior graduate student just so I could get on the guy's path back and forth between coffee, because, man, he drank a lot of coffee. Coffee in his office. And I started plastering up Markov chain diagrams. Right, put them all over my office wall. He had to walk by them every day. I put these matrices, and I'd write Markov chain ? Right, had all his shit all over it, man. And finally, one day he was in there, and he stopped, and he looked at it, and he looked at the sign, and he took out his pen, and where I had Markov chain ? He wrote no, period. And then he kept walking. But that was my opening. I took that off, and I went and just walked in. I didn't make an appointment. I just walked in, and I said, I think it is. And he said, it's not. And I walked away. Came back the next day, had a different one. Is it a Markov chain now? You're getting close. The next day, another one. Is it a Markov chain now? And he said, you're really a hard worker, aren't you? And I said, well, I got a compliment, progress. And he said, but you're never going to get this right without help. And I was like, okay, please help me. And that was it. That was the start of our relationship. I learned more about Markov chains. I can't forget what I know about stochastic processes and Markov chains and machine learning because of that man. We started with walks, right? We would start in the office, and he'd say, listen, want to take a walk? Hell yes, I want to take a walk. And we'd walk around downtown Knoxville, Tennessee, talking about Markov chains, talking about all these things, and walking back. Mentor for life. And I still talk to this guy on a regular basis. We're still really good friends. But I learned Markov chains to a point where I thought in Markov chains. I was seeing Markov chains everywhere, right? This is actually a Markov model here, if we just connect the arcs correctly. And the probability, never mind. And so the contribution was there. I went to him one day and I said, hey, I want to write a paper with you. And that's gold for academics. I want to write the paper. I want to put your name on it. All you have to do is review it. And he's like, totally fine. That's awesome. And we got published in IEEE Transactions on Software Engineering in 1994, a very prestigious journal, and it worked, right? I was giving and receiving, he was giving and receiving. All the mentor-mentee relationships that work are one of those relationships. If you want a mentor, you have to give in order to receive. Now, really, the superpower here isn't just having a mentor, though. It's actually mimicking those mentors. When I explained Markov chains to other people, I did it just like Dr. Thomason did, exactly. I used the inflection of his voice. I used the exact words that he uses. I mimicked him completely. And I absorbed his power that way. I sounded like I knew more than I did because I explained things the same way he explained things. And it worked. People took me seriously. Wow, you really know this stuff. And at the time, I didn't. I ultimately became a master of it, and I think part of that was the mimicry. Mimic the people who are successful.
Talk like them. Walk like them. This is another reason not to have just one mentor, because then you end up a carbon copy of another human being. But if you've got 8 or 9 mentors, you end up a mixture of those people. And you realize you're doing that anyway. We are all, part of us is DNA, and the other part is all learned from our environment. We are learning from other people anyhow. I'm asking you to do it consciously. I'm asking you to really think through who you're learning from, why you're learning it, and act like them. You assume their power. I taught a course. He asked me to teach a course for him one time, and I basically just talked exactly like he did. And it was the best course. That got course of the year or course of the semester or something like that. And I did it simply by mimicking him. You'd be surprised what you learn when you literally mimic another human being. Okay. Now, the nice thing about this is I think I have become a good mentor now because of my good mentors. I've learned this, right? And this is, all of these superpowers, by the way, are leading up to the very last one, which is leadership. All of these superpowers teach you to be a leader. By specializing in something, you become the expert and other people come to you. That's leading. By becoming a great mentor, other people come to you, they want, that's leading, right? All of these things are leading up to leadership. Okay, on to another superpower. Innovation. That's a superpower, right? You hear all these companies talk about innovation, innovation, innovation. Innovation must be a superpower, right? Wrong. Microsoft did not invent desktop computing. Google did not invent search. Apple did not invent the smartphone, and yet they all got credit for it. It's not about innovation at all. And they're still not innovating, right? Microsoft completely missed the web. They completely missed e-commerce. They completely missed search. Google completely missed social. Google completely missed mobile. They had to buy Android. Facebook missed pictures. They missed chat. That cost them $20 billion, right? The combination of those two things. What is this about innovation? Why do we worship innovation when no one's innovating? Innovating doesn't get you ahead. The people who invented the desktop computer didn't make the money on it or didn't get credit for it. Microsoft did. The people who invented search, sorry Yahoo, sorry AltaVista. Google got that. Sorry, MySpace. Facebook won. Innovation is not a superpower, not even close. In fact, if you are the innovator, you're very likely to be the one that doesn't succeed because of that innovation. Everything, all the next big things have already been invented. Everything that's going to be important in 10 years has already been invented. All of these ideas are old. It's not about innovation at all. What it is about is copying. Inventors are really, really the worst. Because once you get that idea, once you get that innovation, you can see the future. And you go toward that future like crazy. And other people are taking a look at it saying, you got that little bit wrong back there. I'm going to do something a little bit different. And they're usually the ones that win. Right? Their passion, their inventor's passion, makes them blind to customers, it makes them blind to users, it makes them blind to alternatives, it makes them blind. So take advantage of that. Look at what other people are inventing and reinvent it. Right? Whoever said reinventing the wheel was a bad thing, go tell Messrs. Goodyear and Firestone that the wheel's already been invented. Don't bother, you're gonna fail. Right? It's reinvention. I call it derivation. That's a superpower. The ability to take an idea and make it better. The ability to take someone else's innovation and come up with the real solution. The solution that actually matters, because that's what Microsoft did with the desktop. That's what Google did with search. Google's only contribution to search was PageRank. That was it. And it was enough. They took someone else's invention and they made themselves wealthy and famous and happy for it. right? Derivation. Train yourself to be able to look at ideas and reinvent them. How do you do this? You got to be able to see the future. How do you see the future? Do you all know what's going to happen in 2 years? I just gave a talk at breakfast. Man, never party until 3 a.m. and then have a 6 o'clock breakfast with a bunch of CEOs. Wow. And I told them the future. I know exactly what's going to happen in 2 years. I know exactly when quantum computing is going to be real. I know exactly when all the other hot tubs are going to be talking to my hot tub. Because I thought about this. You got to keep pace with your industry. How many of you all, I want you to, we're all basically in the computing industry. I want you to stop. Don't say this out loud. Name a website that talks about the computing industry. Now name another one. Now name another one. Now name another one. Another. A sixth one. Seven. Eight. I'll give you a little second. Ninth one. Tenth one. Did anybody get through it? Don't shake your head. You didn't. Unless you're really up on your field. Are you up on your field? Why wouldn't you be? If you don't understand the present, you can't predict the future. I want you to read. I read industry news. I consume it like a madhouse. Right now, I've got spies back home sitting at the Apple event telling me what's going on, right? I have an entire network of people that do nothing but mine data. I've got friends at Google. I've got friends at Apple. I've got friends at Facebook. We all sit around and talk. It's a superpower to be able to outdrink people. That one's not in the book. I'm only giving that one to you all for free today. And we do. We sit around and we discuss these things. Why do you think Apple bought Beats? Why do you think Microsoft bought Skype? Why do you think Google is doing what Google is doing? What if Facebook did this? And we pose questions to each other. Okay, you're the CEO of Facebook. How do you kill Google? All right? These are the things that we talk about on a regular basis. We talk about these things all the time. And you learn from other like-minded people. About 10% of the email I get, and I get a lot of emails, so this is a lot of email. About 10% of the emails I get are, hey, James, did you see this? Here's what I think it means. What do you think? And we predict the future. What do you think is going to happen? We actually write it down on little cards. December 31st, 2016, the following things will be achieved, X, Y, and Z. And we put them in an envelope. We give them to a third party, and then we pull them out on that day. We always get together on January 1st for a few beers, you know, hair of the dog kind of thing. And we open them up, and we talk about them. And for the last few years, we've been right every single time, me and my little group of conspirators. They're all over the world. Wherever they are, they have to have a beer with us, and we all do a don't tweet this either, a Google Hangouts. Your job is to see the future faster than the next guy and then get there. That's your job. And if you can do it, it's a superpower. All right, let's talk about creativity. Clairvoyance will allow you to get ahead. And now what you need to do is you need to be really, really ultra creative in order to be able to do something about it. Clairvoyance allows you to see the future. Creativity allows you to get to the future. So let's talk a little bit about creativity. Where's my good slides? Here's my good slides. So the first part of creativity is ritual. I have rituals, and I execute those rituals every single day. Every single day, I never fail to use my rituals. Every single work day. The other days, fuck it. And a routine, because a routine helps you get into the creative mood. Have you ever been to a point where you just couldn't create? You're a writer and you got writer's block. You're a coder and you can't code. You have that one of those, fuck it, I'm going to stay on the couch kind of things. It's because of a lack of ritual. If you look at all the creative people on the planet, all of them agree on this. All the research on creativity points to ritual as a way to create it, right? And all of these people in this graphic, I love this graphic, all the people in this graphic had rituals, and that's what their rituals were. They slept at certain times. They did certain things in the morning. Here's my ritual. I wake up early because I want to be up before anybody else in my house. I want that peace and quiet. I take the dog out. Dog has a piss. I get the newspaper. Walk back in. I don't know why I get a newspaper except it's part of my ritual. I don't read the damn thing. And I walk back into the house. By then, my coffee is brewing, and I sit, and I have 6 cups of coffee. Half strength. I use half decaf beans and grind it myself, right? 6 cups of coffee before anybody else is up, and that's when I do my work. That's when I do my, I don't read the news. I don't check my email. I create. I work on whatever paper I'm working on. I write some of my hot tub code. Or I'll work on some slides. I'm not very good at slides, and my PowerPoint was harmed in the making of this presentation. That's when I do my creative work. And after the 6th cup of coffee, I stop, and I'm useless for hours. And that's when I read my email. That's when I look at my Twitter feed. That's when I do all the things that really don't require creativity. And then in the evenings, it's beer. Yes, psychedelics and vices make me creative. They do. It's beer. I drink beer and I go back to my creative work. I don't even try to be creative in the middle of the day because I can't, and so I worked my routine around it. What is your routine? What are your rituals? Do you have one? I have a ritual for speaking. You all didn't see it all. I talk about my ritual for speaking in my storytelling class. Let me tell you part of it. Part of it is a physical part. I was back there doing push-ups earlier. I ran these stairs 2 or 3 times. I went and walked around. I always try to find a picture, take a picture of something, and then tweet it and say I'm starting my talk. If you heard the music playing before I started, that was a Seattle band that I follow and that I love. And yesterday, before I got up on stage, they wanted to play this music, and I'm like, you're not playing. I want to control the song. I want to hear some Neil Young when I take that stage, rocking in the free world, baby, because it is part of my ritual. It's part of the reason that I succeed. It's part of the reason that I'm creative. It gets me ready. Now my body knows, okay, you're on stage, you're ready to go. I was in the Digital Life Design in Munich. Is that the conference? Yeah. I'm back in the speaker room behind the stage, and it's 5 minutes before I go on. I drop back, and I do 50 push-ups. I just crank them out, right? Everybody's like, who the fuck is this guy? And then I go out, and I give my talk, and I nailed it, man. I really felt good about the talk. I watched everybody clap, and it turns out I won best presentation at the conference. So I was like, all right, man. Wow, I feel really good about myself. And then the conference promoter, the woman who ran it, came to me, and she said, James, we're never going to invite you back to DLD. I'm like, what? I thought I won. Was there a mistake? She's like, oh, no, your talk was fine. She said, but go in my speaker room. Go in my damn speaker room right now, James. Everybody's doing push-ups, James. All the speakers are doing push-ups, James. I don't want peace speakers doing push-ups in my room. You cannot do this if you come back to this conference. It's part of my ritual, right? And when I take the stage, I know my mind is ready. It's clear. It's focused. I'm good. Create a ritual. They're very powerful. Very powerful. Another part of creativity is distraction. There's parts of your brain that are being used when you're creative. And you got to turn those things off sometimes. You got to do something else. What is distracting to you? You know, taking a walk, doing something, getting out. Force yourself to use another part of your brain so that the creative parts of your brain can rest. You need these breaks. Your brain needs these breaks. So figure out what distractions work for you. The way you know is that you do a distraction and you come back and you be creative again. So experiment with distractions. Do a whole bunch of different things. What is it that makes you stop thinking about what you're thinking about and doing something completely else? Make that brain stop. And if it doesn't work, if you go back and you're not creative, that's not the right distraction for you. So keep experimenting. Find the distractions that work. and be centered. Do you have a place, a spot, where you just feel really comfortable? Do y'all get this show here? Isn't it funny? That guy is a genius actor, an absolute genius. Do you have that spot? Where are you really centered? What is the part of the world where you're just like, yeah, this is where I was meant to be? I have three. Forests. I love to be in a forest. I love to walk. I just do. And I'm really centered in my hot tub. I am, because the rest of my family detests the thing and I can be alone. Right? There's no music playing. I'm hot. I'm warm. I look up into the rain. I was going to say the stars. I saw them once. And the third, it's a freaking brewery. I love breweries, not just pubs, but breweries. The smell of the grains, the smell of the hops. I love it. I feel centered. I feel happy. You've seen my ass smile when I walk in, right? And he's like, oh, look. I mean, everybody, we're all walking up to the brewery, and all of a sudden, James is like this. Woo, he's way ahead of everybody. Where's your centered spot? Do you know? If you don't, fix it. Where is that spot that you can go and your brain just relaxes? Find it, because it's a powerful distraction. And it's a way for your brain to relax and recuperate. This is science. It's not just me. Okay. I haven't gone through them all. Do I have any time left? No. I'm 1 minute over. These are the other superpowers that I haven't talked about. Passion. I guess I got some of them. I didn't get leadership. I have a whole spiel on how to lead. It's not management, by the way. Leaders don't have to be managers, and there are secrets to leadership. If you're interested in more of this stuff, I did write a book. Go to Amazon.com, it's Kindle store, and search for it. It's the only place I publish it is at the Kindle store. It's still a work in progress. It's going to be updated. You have to pay for it. And I'm charging for it for two reasons. One, it gives me a pool of money that I can give away. I like giving money away. And this one is, you know, it's tailor-made for, right now the charity is sending underprivileged kids to college, mostly black kids. And two, I can track whether or not this matters. When you give shit away for free, everybody wants it. If you make people pay, you create a barrier and you know you've got somebody who uses it. I can look at returns and I can track my data and understand, am I making an impact? Because I have a goal to make an impact with this material eventually. Okay, so there's a longer version. Maybe you'll invite me back to, oh, I don't know, the South Island. And we can do the whole thing. My name is James Whitaker. I hope you accept these superpowers. And they're my gift to you. Thank you all very much.